and for company, and a third because two families had pioneered the place and found it good. And when the sun went down, perhaps 20 families and 20 cars were there. In the evening, a strange thing happened. The 20 families became one family. The children were the children of all. The loss of home became one loss, and the golden time in the West was one dream. And it might be that a sick child threw despair into the hearts of 20 families, of 100 people, that a birth there in a tent kept 100 people quiet and awestruck through the night, and filled 100 people with the birth joy in the morning. A family, which the night before had been lost and fearful, might search its goods to find a present for a new baby. In the evening, sitting about the fires, the 20 were one. They grew to be units of the camps, units of the evenings and the nights. A guitar unwrapped from a blanket and tuned, and the songs, which were all of the people, were sung in the nights. Men sang the words, and women hummed the tunes. Every night a world created, complete with furniture, friends made and enemies established, a world complete with braggarts and with cowards, with quiet men, with humble men, with kindly men. Every night relationships that make a world established, and every morning the world torn down like a circus. At first, the families were timid in the building and tumbling worlds, but gradually the technique of building worlds became their technique. Then leaders emerged, then laws were made, then codes came into being. And as the worlds moved westward, they were more complete and better furnished, for their builders were more experienced in building them. The families learned what rights must be observed. The right of privacy in the tent, the right to keep the past black hidden in the heart, the right to talk and to listen, the right to refuse help or to accept, to offer help or to decline it, the right of son to court and daughter to be courted, the right of the hungry to be fed, the rights of the pregnant and the sick to transcend all other rights. And the families learned, although no one told them, what rights are monstrous and must be destroyed. The right to intrude upon privacy, the right to be noisy while the camp slept, the right of seduction or rape, the right of adultery and theft and murder. These rights were crushed because the little worlds could not exist for even a night with such rights alive. And as the worlds moved westward, rules became laws, although no one told the families. It is unlawful to foul near the camp. It is unlawful in any way to foul the drinking water. It is unlawful to eat good, rich food near one who is hungry, unless he is asked to share. And with the laws, the punishments, and there were only two, a quick and murderous fight or ostracism. And ostracism was the worst, for if one broke the laws, his name and face went with him, and he had no place in any world, no matter where created. In the worlds, social conduct became fixed and rigid, so that a man must say good morning when asked for it, so that a man might have a willing girl if he stayed with her, if he fathered her children and protected them. But a man might not have one girl one night and another the next, for this would endanger the worlds. The families moved westward, and the technique of building the worlds improved so that the people could be safe in their worlds, and the form was so fixed that a family acting in the rules knew it was safe in the rules. There grew up government in the worlds, with leaders, with elders. A man who was wise found that his wisdom was needed in every camp. A man who was a fool could not change his folly with his world. And a kind of insurance developed in these nights. A man with food fed a hungry man, and thus insured himself against hunger. And when a baby died, a pile of silver coins grew at the door flap, for a baby must be well buried, since it has had nothing else of life. An old man may be left in a potter's field, but not a baby. A certain physical pattern is needed for the building of a world. Water, a riverbank, stream, a spring, or even a faucet unguarded. And there is needed enough flat land to pitch the tents, a little brush or wood to build the fires. If there is a garbage dump not too far off, all the better, for there can be found equipment, stovetops, a curved fender to shelter the fire, and cans to cook in and to eat from. And the worlds were built in the evening. The people moving in from the highways made them with their tents and their hearts and their brains. In the morning, the tents came down, the canvas was folded, the tent poles tied along the running board, the beds put in place on the cars, the pots in their places. And as the families moved westward, the technique of building up a home in the evening and tearing it down with the morning light became fixed, so that the folded tent was packed in one place, the cooking pots counted in their box. And as the cars moved westward, each member of the family grew into his proper place, grew into his duties, so that each member, old and young, had his place in the car, so that in the weary, hot evenings, when the cars pulled into the camping places, each member had his duty and went to it without instruction. Children to gather wood, to carry water. Men to pitch the tents and bring down the beds. Women to cook the supper and to watch while the family fed. And this was done without command. The families, which had been units of which the boundaries were a house at night, a farm by day, changed their boundaries. In the long, hot light, they were silent in the cars moving slowly westward. But at night, they integrated with any group they found. Thus, they changed their social life, changed as in the whole universe only man can change. They were not farm men anymore, but migrant men. And the thought, the planning, the long staring silence that had gone out to the fields went now to the roads, to the distance, to the west. That man whose mind had been bound with acres lived with narrow concrete miles, and his thought and his worry were not any more with rainfall, with wind and dust, with the thrust of the crops. Eyes watched the tires, ears listened to the clattering motors, and minds struggled with oil, with gasoline, with the thinning rubber between air and road. Then a broken gear was tragedy. Then water in the evening was the yearning, and food over the fire. Then health to go on was the need and strength to go on, and spirit to go on. The wills thrust westward ahead of them, and fears that had once apprehended drought or flood now lingered with anything that might stop the westward crawling. The camps became fixed, each a short day's journey from the last. And on the road, the panic overcame some of the families, so that they drove night and day, stopped to sleep in the cars, and drove on to the west, flying from the road, flying from movement. And these lusted so greatly to be settled that they set their faces into the west and drove toward it, forcing the clashing engines over the roads. But most of the families changed and grew quickly into the new life. And when the sun went down, "Time to look for a place to stop," and "There's some tents ahead," the car pulled off the road and stopped, and because others were there first, certain courtesies were necessary, and the man, the leader of the family, leaned from the car. "Can we pull up here and sleep?" "Why, sure. Be proud to have you. What state you from?" "Come all the way from Arkansas." "They's Arkansas people down that fourth tent." "That's so. And the great question, how's the water?"
"Well, she don't taste so good, but they's plenty."
"Well, thank you. No thanks to me." But the courtesies had to be. The car lumbered over the ground to the end tent and stopped. Then down from the car the weary people climbed and stretched stiff bodies. Then the new tent sprang up. The children went for water, and the older boys cut brush or wood. The fire started, and supper was put on to boil or to fry. Early comers moved over, and states were exchanged, and friends and sometimes relatives discovered.
Oklahoma, huh? What county?
Cherokee.
Why, I got folks there. Know the Allens?
They's Allens all over Cherokee. Know the Willises?
Why, sure.
And a new unit was formed. The dusk came, but before the dark was down, the new family was of the camp. A word had been passed with every family. They were known people, good people.
I knowed the Allens all my life. Simon Allen, old Simon, had trouble with his first wife. She was part Cherokee. Purdy is as a black colt.
Sure. And young Simon, he married a Rudolph, didn't he? That's what I thought. They went to live in Enid and done well, real well. Only Allen that ever done well. Got a garage. When the water was carried and the wood cut, the children walked shyly, cautiously among the tents, and they made elaborate acquaintanceship gestures. A boy stopped near another boy and studied a stone, picked it up, examined it closely, spat on it, and rubbed it clean and inspected it, until he forced the other to demand, "What you go there?" And casually,
"Nothing. Just a rock."
"Well, what you looking at it like that for?"
"Thought I seen gold in it."
"How'd you know? Gold ain't gold. It's black in a rock."
"Sure. Everybody knows that."
"I bet it's fool's gold and you figured it was gold."
"That ain't so, 'cause Pa, he found lots of gold, and he told me how to look."
"How'd you like to pick up a big old piece of gold? Say, I'd get the biggest old son of bitchin' piece of candy you ever seen."
"I ain't let to swear, but I do anyways."
"Me too. Let's go to the spring."
And young girls found each other and boasted shyly of their popularity and their prospects. The women worked over the fire, hurrying to get food to the stomachs of the family. Pork, if there was money in plenty, pork and potatoes and onions, Dutch oven biscuits or cornbread, and plenty of gravy to go over it, side meat or chops, and a can of boiled tea, black and bitter, fried dough and drippings if money was slim, dough fried crisp and brown, and the drippings poured over it. Those families which were very rich or very foolish with their money ate canned beans and canned peaches and packaged bread and bakery cake, but they ate secretly in their tents, for it would not have been good to eat such fine things openly. Even so, children eating their fried dough smelled the warming beans and were unhappy about it. When supper was over and the dishes dipped and wiped, the dark had come, and then the men squatted down to talk. And they talked of the land behind them.
"I don't know what it's coming to," they said. "The country's spoilt.
It'll come back, though. Only we won't be there."
"Maybe," they thought. "Maybe we sinned some way we didn't know about."
"Fella says to me, government fella, and he says, 'She's gullied up on you.' Government fella. He says, 'If you plowed across the contour, she won't gully.' Never did have no chance to try her. And the new super ain't plowing across the contour, running a furrow 4 miles long that ain't stopping or going around Jesus Christ hisself." And they spoke softly of their homes. There was a little cool house under the windmill. Used to keep milk in there to cream up, and watermelons. Go in there midday when she was hotter than a heifer, and she'd be just as cool as you'd want. Cut open a melon in there and she'd hurt your mouth, she was so cool. Water dripping down from the tank. They spoke of their tragedies. Had a brother Charlie, hair as yellow as corn, and him a growed man. Played the accordion nice, too. He was harrowing one day, and he went up to clear his lines. Well, a rattlesnake buzzed, and them horses bolted, and the harrow went over Charlie, and the points dug into his guts and his stomach, and they pulled his face off, and God almighty. They spoke of the future.
Wonder what it's like out there.
Well, the pictures sure do look nice. I seen one where it's hot and fine and walnut trees and berries. And right behind, close as a mule's ass to his withers, they's a tall up mountain covered with snow. That was a pretty thing to see. If we can get work, it'll be fine. Won't have no cold in the winter. Kids won't freeze on the way to school. I'm gonna take care my kids don't miss no more school. I can read good, but it ain't no pleasure to me like with a fella that's used to it.
And perhaps a man brought out his guitar in front of his tent, and he sat on a box to play, and everyone in the camp moved slowly in toward him, drawn in toward him. Many men can chord a guitar, but perhaps this man was a picker. There you have something, the deep chords beating, beating, while the melody runs on the strings like little footsteps, heavy, hard fingers marching on the frets. The man played, and the people moved slowly in on him until the circle was closed and tight, and then he sang, 10 cent cotton and 40 cent meat. And the circle sang softly with him, and he sang, Why do you cut your hair, girls? And the circle sang. He wailed the song, I'm leaving old Texas, that eerie song that was sung before the Spaniards came, only the words were Indian then. And now the group was welded to one thing, one unit, so that in the dark the eyes of the people were inward, and their minds played in other times, and their sadness was like rest, like sleep. He sang the McAllister Blues, and then, to make up for it to the older people, he sang Jesus Calls Me to His Side. The children drowsed with the music and went into the tents to sleep, and the singing came into their dreams. And after a while, the man with the guitar stood up and yawned. Good night, folks, he said. And they murmured, Good night to you. And each wished he could pick a guitar, because it is a gracious thing. Then the people went to their beds, and the camp was quiet, and the owls coasted overhead, and the coyotes gabbled in the distance, and into the camp skunks walked, looking for bits of food, waddling, arrogant skunks, afraid of nothing. The night passed, and with the first streak of dawn the women came out of the tents, built up the fires, and put the coffee to boil. And the men came out, and talk softly in the dawn. When you cross the Colorado River, there's the desert, they say. Look out for the desert. See you don't get hung up. Take plenty of water, case you get hung up. I'm gonna take her at night. Me too. She'll cut the living Jesus out of you. The families ate quickly, and the dishes were dipped and wiped. The tents came down. There was a rush to go. And when the sun arose, the camping place was vacant, only a little litter left by the people, and the camping place was ready for a new world and a new night. But along the highway, the cars of the migrant people crawled out like bugs, and the narrow concrete miles stretched ahead.
Chapter 18. The Joad family moved slowly westward, up into the mountains of New Mexico, past the pinnacles and pyramids of the upland. They climbed into the high country of Arizona, and through a gap, they looked down on the painted desert. A border guard stopped them. Where are you going?
To California, said Tom.
How long you plan to be in Arizona?
No longer than we can get across her.
Got any plants?
No plants.
I ought to look your stuff over.
I tell you, we ain't got no plants.
The guard put a little sticker on the windshield. Okay, go ahead, but you better keep moving.
Sure, we aim to.
They crawled up the slopes, and the low, twisted trees covered the slopes. Holbrook, Joseph City, Winslow. And then the tall trees began, and the car spouted steam and labored up the slopes. And there was Flagstaff, and that was the top of it all. Down from Flagstaff over the great plateaus, and the road disappeared in the distance ahead. The water grew scarce. Water was to be bought, 5 cents, 10 cents, 15 cents a gallon. The sun drained the dry, rocky country, and ahead were jagged, broken peaks, the western wall of Arizona. And now they were in flight from the sun and the drought. They drove all night, and came to the mountains in the night. And they crawled the jagged ramparts in the night, and their dim lights flickered on the pale stone walls of the road. They passed the summit in the dark, and came slowly down in the late night, through the shattered stone debris of Oatman. And when the daylight came, they saw the Colorado River below them. They drove to Topak, pulled up at the bridge while a guard washed off the windshield sticker. Then across the bridge, and into the broken rock wilderness. And although they were dead weary and the morning heat was growing, they stopped. Pa called,
"We're there. We're in California."
They looked dully at the broken rock glaring under the sun, and across the river, the terrible ramparts of Arizona.
"We got the desert," said Tom. "We got to get to the water and rest."
The road runs parallel to the river, and it was well into the morning when the burning motors came to Needles, where the river runs swiftly among the reeds. The Jodes and Wilsons drove to the river, and they sat in the cars looking at the lovely water flowing by, and the green reeds jerking slowly in the current. There was a little encampment by the river, 11 tents near the water, and the swamp grass on the ground. And Tom leaned out of the truck window.
"Mind if we stop here a piece?"
A stout woman, scrubbing clothes in a bucket, looked up.
"We don't own it, mister. Stop if you want. There'll be a cop down to look you over."
And she went back to her scrubbing in the sun. The two cars pulled to a clear place on the swamp grass. The tents were passed down, the Wilson tent set up, the Jode tarpaulin stretched over its rope. Winfield and Ruthie walked slowly down through the willows to the reedy place. Ruthie said with soft vehemence,
"California. This here's California, and we're right in it."
Winfield broke a tule and twisted it free, and he put the white pulp in his mouth and chewed it. They walked into the water and stood quietly, the water about the calves of their legs.
"We got the desert yet," Ruthie said.
"What's the desert like?"
"I don't know. I seen pictures once," says a desert. "They was bones every place."
"Man bones?"
"Some, I guess, but mostly cow bones."
"We gonna get to see them bones?"
"Maybe. I don't know. Gonna go crosster at night."
That's what Tom said.
"Tom says we get the living Jesus burned out of us if we go in daylight."
"Feels nice and cool,"
said Winfield, and he squidged his toes in the sand of the bottom. They heard Ma calling, "Ruthie? Winfield, you come back." They turned and walked slowly back through the reeds and the willows. The other tents were quiet. For a moment, when the cars came up, a few heads had stuck out between the flaps and then were withdrawn. Now the family tents were up, and the men gathered together. Tom said,
"I'm gonna go down and take a bath. That's what I'm gonna do before I sleep. How's Grandma since we got her in the tent?"
"Don't know," said Pa. "Couldn't seem to wake her up."
He cocked his head toward the tent. A whining, babbling voice came from under the canvas. Ma went quickly inside.
"She woke up all right," said Noah. "Seems like all night she was a-croaking up on the truck. She's all out of sense."
Tom said,
"Hell, she's wore out. If she don't get some rest pretty soon, she ain't gonna last. She's just wore out. Anybody coming with me? I'm gonna wash and I'm gonna sleep in the shade all day long."
He moved away, and the other men followed him. They took off their clothes in the willows, and then they walked into the water and sat down. For a long time they sat, holding themselves with heels dug into the sand, and only their heads stuck out of the water.
"Jesus, I needed this," Al said.
He took a handful of sand from the bottom and scrubbed himself with it. They lay in the water and looked across at the sharp peaks called Needles and at the White Rock Mountains of Arizona.
"We come through them," Pa said in wonder.
Uncle John ducked his head under the water.
"Well, we're here. This here's California, and she don't look so prosperous."
"Got the desert yet," said Tom, "and I hear she's a son of a bitch." Noah asked,
"Gonna try her tonight?"
"What you think, Pa?" Tom asked.
"Well, I don't know. Do us good to get a little rest, especially Grandma. But other ways, I'd kind of like to get across to her and get settled into a job. Only got about $40 left. I'll feel better when we're all working and a little money coming in."
Each man sat in the water and felt the tug of the current. The preacher let his arms and hands float on the surface. The bodies were white to the neck and wrists and burned dark brown on hands and faces, with V's of brown at the collarbones. They scratched themselves with sand, and Noah said lazily,
"Like to just stay here. Like to lay here forever. Never get hungry and never get sad. Lay in the water all life long. Lazy as a brood sow in the mud."
And Tom, looking at the ragged peaks across the river and the needles downstream,
"Never seen such tough mountains. This here's a murder country. This here's the bones of a country. Wonder if we'll ever get in a place where folks can live without fighting hard, scrabbling rocks. I seen pictures of a country flat and green, and the little houses, like Ma says, white. Ma got her heart set on a white house. Get to thinking there ain't no such country. I seen pictures like that."
Pa said,
"Wait till we get to California. You'll see nice country then."
"Jesus Christ, Pa, this here is California."
Two men dressed in jeans and sweaty blue shirts came through the willows and looked toward the naked men. They called, "How's the swimming?"
"Dunno," said Tom. "We ain't tried none. Sure feels good to set here, though. Mind if we come in and set?" "She ain't our river. We'll lend you a little piece of her."
The men shucked off their pants, peeled their shirts, and waded out. The dust coated their legs to the knee. Their feet were pale and soft with sweat. They settled lazily into the water and washed listlessly at their flanks. Sunbitten they were, a father and a boy. They grunted and groaned with the water. Pa asked politely,
"Going west?"
"Nope, we come from there. Going back home. We can't make no living out there."
"Where's home?" Tom asked.
"Panhandle. Come from near Pampa."
Pa asked,
"Can you make a living there?"
"Nope, but at least we can starve to death with folks we know. Won't have a bunch of fellas that hates us to starve with."
Pa said,
"You know, you're the second fella talk like that. What makes 'em hate you?"
"Dunno," said the man.
He cupped his hands full of water and rubbed his face, snorting and bubbling. Dusty water ran out of his hair and streaked his neck.
"I like to hear some more about this," said Pa.
"Me too," Tom added. "Why these folks out west hate you?"
The man looked sharply at Tom.
"You just going west?"
"Just on our way."
"You ain't never been in California?"
"No, we ain't."
"Well, don't take my word. Go see for yourself."
"Yeah," Tom said, "but a fella kinda likes to know what he's getting into."
"Well,
if you truly want to know,
I'm a fella that's asked questions and give her some thought. She's a nice country, but she was stole a long time ago. You get across the desert and come into the country round Bakersfield, and you never seen such purty country. All orchards and grapes. Purtiest country you ever seen. And you'll pass land flat and fine with water 30 feet down, and that land's laying fallow. And you can't have none of that land. That's a land and cattle company. And if they don't want a worker, she ain't gonna get worked. You go in there and plant your little corn, and you'll go to jail. Good land, you say? And they ain't working her? Yes, sir. Good land, and they ain't. Well, sir, that'll get you a little mad, but you ain't seen nothing. People gonna have a look in their eye. They gonna look at you, and their face says, I don't like you, you son of a bitch. Gonna be deputy sheriffs, and they'll push you around. You camp on the roadside, and they'll move you on. You're gonna see in people's face how they hate you. And I'll tell you something. They hate you because they're scared. They know a hungry fella gonna get food even if he gotta take it. They know that fella land's a sin and somebody gonna take it. What the hell? You never been called Okey yet. Tom said, Okey? What's that? Well, Okey used to mean you was from Oklahoma. Now, it means you're a dirty son of a bitch. Okey means you're scum. Don't mean nothing itself, it's the way they say it. But I can't tell you nothing. You gotta go there. I hear there's 300,000 of our people there, living like hogs, because everything in California is owned. They ain't nothing left. And them people that owns it is gonna hang on to it if they gotta kill everybody in the world to do it. And they're scared, and that makes them mad. You gotta see it. You gotta hear it. Purtiest goddamn country you ever seen. But they ain't nice to you, them folks. They're so scared and worried, they ain't even nice to each other. Tom looked down into the water, and he dug his heels into the sand. Suppose a fella got work and saved. Couldn't he get a little land? The older man laughed and he looked at his boy, and his silent boy grinned almost in triumph, and the man said, You ain't gonna get no steady work. Gonna scrabble for your dinner every day. And you gonna do her with people looking mean at you. Pick cotton, and you gonna be sure the scales ain't honest. Some of 'em is, some of 'em ain't. But you gonna think all the scales is crooked, and you don't know which ones. Ain't nothing you can do about her anyways. Pa asked slowly, Ain't it nice out there at all? Sure, nice to look at, but you can't have none of it. They's a grove of yellow oranges, and a guy with a gun that got the right to kill you if you touch one. They's a fella. Newspaper fella near the coast. Got 1,000,000 acres. Casey looked up quickly. 1,000,000 acres? What in the world can he do with 1,000,000 acres? I dunno. He just got 'em. Runs a few cattle. Got guards every place to keep folks out. Rides around in a bulletproof car. I seen pictures of him. Fat, soft fella. With little mean eyes and a mouth like a asshole. Scared he's gonna die. Got 1,000,000 acres and scared of dying. Casey demanded, What in hell can he do with 1,000,000 acres? What's he want 1,000,000 acres for? The man took his whitening, puckering hands out of the water and spread them, and he tightened his lower lip and bent his head down to one shoulder. I don't know, he said. Guess he's crazy. Must be crazy. Seen a picture of him. He looks crazy. Crazy and mean. Say he's scared to die? Casey asked. That's what I heard. Scared God'll get him? I don't know. Just scared. What's he care?
Pa said. Don't seem like he's having no fun.
Grandpa wasn't scared, Tom said. When Grandpa was having the most fun, he come closest to getting killed. Time Grandpa and another fella wanged into a bunch of Navajo in the night. They was having the time of their life. And same time, you wouldn't give a gopher for their chance. Casey said,
Seems like that's the way. Fella having fun, he don't give a damn. But a fella mean and lonely and old and disappointed, he's scared of dying.
Pa asked,
What's he disappointed about if he got 1,000,000 acres?
The preacher smiled, and he looked puzzled. He splashed a floating water bug away with his hand.
If he needs 1,000,000 acres to make him feel rich, seems to me he needs it 'cause he feels awful poor inside hisself. And if he's poor in hisself, there ain't 1,000,000 acres gonna make him feel rich. And maybe he's disappointed that nothing he can do'll make him feel rich. Not rich like Ms. Wilson was when she give a tent when Grandpa died. I ain't trying to preach no sermon, but I never seen nobody that's busy as a prairie dog collecting stuff that wasn't disappointed.
He grinned.
Does kind of sound like a sermon, don't it?
The sun was flaming fiercely now. Pa said,
Better scrunch down underwater. She'll burn the living Jesus out of you.
And he reclined and let the gently moving water flow around his neck.
If a fella's willing to work hard, can he cut her?
Pa asked. The man sat up and faced him.
Look, mister, I don't know everything. You might go out there and fall into a steady job, and I'd be a liar. And then you might never get no work, and I didn't warn you. I can tell you, most of the folks is pretty miserable.
He lay back in the water.
Fella don't know everything, he said.
Pa turned his head and looked at Uncle John.
You never was a fella to say much,
Pa said.
But I'll be goddamned if you open your mouth twice since we left home. What you think about this here?
Uncle John scowled.
I don't think nothing about it. We're a-going there, ain't we? None of this here talk gonna keep us from going there. When we get there, we'll get there. When we get a job, we'll work. And when we don't get a job, we'll sit on our tail. This here talk ain't gonna do no good no way.
Tom lay back and filled his mouth with water, and he spurted it into the air and he laughed. Uncle John don't talk much, but he talks sense. Yes, by God, he talks sense. We going on tonight, Pa?
Might's well. Might's well get her over.
Well, I'm going up in the brush and get some sleep then. Tom stood up and waded to the sandy shore. He slipped his clothes on his wet body and winced under the heat of the cloth. The others followed him. In the water, the man and his boy watched the Joads disappear, and the boy said,
Like to see 'em in 6 months. Jesus.
The man wiped his eye corners with his forefinger.
I shouldn't have did that, he said. Fella always wants to be a wise guy, wants to tell folks stuff.
Well, Jesus, Pa, they asked for it.
Yeah, I know, but like that fella says, they're a-going anyways. Nothing won't be changed from what I told 'em, except they'll be miserable for they have to.
Tom walked in among the willows, and he crawled into a cave of shade to lie down, and Noah followed him.
Gonna sleep here, Tom said.
Tom?
Yeah?
Tom, I ain't a-going on.
Tom sat up.
What you mean?
Tom, I ain't a-gonna leave this here water. I'm a-gonna walk on down this here river.
You're crazy, Tom said.
Get myself a piece of line. I'll catch fish. Fella can't starve beside a nice river.
Tom said,
How about the family? How about Ma? I can't help it. I can't leave this here water.
Noah's wide-set eyes were half closed.
You know how it is, Tom. You know how the folks are nice to me, but they don't really care for me.
You're crazy.
No, I ain't. I know how I am. I know they're sorry, but, well, I ain't a-going. You tell Ma, Tom.
Now you look a-here, Tom began.
No, it ain't no use. I was in that there water, and I ain't a-gonna leave her. I'm a-gonna go now, Tom, down the river. I'll catch fish and stuff, but I can't leave her. I can't.
He crawled back out of the willow cave.
You tell Ma, Tom.
He walked away. Tom followed him to the riverbank.
Listen, you goddamn fool.
It ain't no use, Noah said. I'm sad, but I can't help it. I got to go.
He turned abruptly and walked downstream along the shore. Tom started to follow, and then he stopped. He saw Noah disappear into the brush and then appear again following the edge of the river, and he watched Noah growing smaller on the edge of the river until he disappeared into the willows at last. And Tom took off his cap and scratched his head. He went back to his willow cave and lay down to sleep. Under the spread tarpaulin, Grandma lay on a mattress, and Ma sat beside her. The air was stiflingly hot, and the flies buzzed in the shade of the canvas. Grandma was naked under a long piece of pink curtain. She turned her old head restlessly from side to side, and she muttered and choked. Ma sat on the ground beside her, and with a piece of cardboard drove the flies away and fanned a stream of moving hot air over the tight old face. Rose of Sharon sat on the other side and watched her mother. Grandma called imperiously,
Will! Will! You come here, Will!
And her eyes opened, and she looked fiercely about.
Told him to come right here,
she said.
I'll catch him. I'll take the hair off of him.
She closed her eyes and rolled her head back and forth and muttered thickly. Ma fanned with the cardboard. Rose of Sharon looked helplessly at the old woman. She said softly,
She's awful sick.
Ma raised her eyes to the girl's face. Ma's eyes were patient, but the lines of strain were on her forehead. Ma fanned and fanned the air, and her piece of cardboard warned off the flies.
When you're young, Rose of Sharon, everything that happens is a thing all by itself. It's a lonely thing. I know, I remember, Rose of Sharon.
Her mouth loved the name of her daughter.
You're going to have a baby, Rose of Sharon, and that's something to you lonely in a way. That's going to hurt you, and the hurt'll be lonely hurt. And this here tent is alone in the world, Rose of Sharon.
She whipped the air for a moment to drive a buzzing blowfly on, and the big shining fly circled the tent twice and zoomed out into the blinding sunlight. And Ma went on,
There's a time of change, and when that comes, dyin' is a piece of all dyin', and barren is a piece of all barren, and barren and dyin' is two pieces of the same thing. And then things ain't lonely anymore. And then a hurt don't hurt so bad, 'cause it ain't a lonely hurt no more, Rose of Sharon. I wished I could tell you so you'd know, but I can't. And her voice was so soft, so full of love, that tears crowded into Rose of Sharon's eyes and flowed over her eyes and blinded her.
Take and fan Grandma, Ma said, and she handed the cardboard to her daughter. That's a good thing to do. I wished I could tell you so you'd know. Grandma, scowling her brows down over her closed eyes, bleated,
"Well, you're dirty. You ain't never gonna get clean."
Her little wrinkled claws moved up and scratched her cheek. A red ant ran up the curtain cloth and scrambled over the folds of loose skin on the old lady's neck. Ma reached quickly and picked it off, crushed it between thumb and forefinger, and brushed her fingers on her dress. Rose of Sharon waved the cardboard fan. She looked up at Ma.
"She..."
and the words parched in her throat.
"Wipe your feet, Will, you dirty pig!"
Grandma cried. Ma said, "I dunno. Maybe if we can get her where it ain't so hot. But I dunno. Don't worry yourself, Rosa Sharn. Take your breath in when you need it, and let it go when you need to." A large woman in a torn black dress looked into the tent. Her eyes were bleared and indefinite, and the skin sagged to her jowls and hung down in little flaps. Her lips were loose, so that the upper lip hung like a curtain over her teeth, and her lower lip, by its weight, folded outward, showing her lower gums.
"Morning, ma'am," she said. "Morning, and praise God for victory."
Ma looked around. "Morning," she said. The woman stooped into the tent and bent her head over Grandma.
"We heard you got a soul here ready to join her Jesus. Praise God."
Ma's face tightened, and her eyes grew sharp. "She's tired, that's all," Ma said. "She's wore out with the road and the heat. She's just wore out. Get a little rest and she'll be well." The woman leaned down over Grandma's face, and she seemed almost to sniff. Then she turned to Ma and nodded quickly, and her lips jiggled and her jowls quivered.
"A dear soul gonna join her Jesus," she said.
Ma cried, "That ain't so." The woman nodded, slowly this time, and put a puffy hand on Grandma's forehead. Ma reached to snatch the hand away, and quickly restrained herself.
"Yes, it's so, sister,"
the woman said.
"We got 6 in holiness in our tent. I'll go get 'em, and we'll hold a meeting of prayer and grace. Jehovah, it's all. 6 counting me. I'll go get 'em out."
Ma stiffened. "No, no," she said. "No, Grandma's tired. She couldn't stand a meeting." The woman said,
"Couldn't stand grace? Couldn't stand the sweet breath of Jesus? What you talking about, sister?"
Ma said, "No, not here. She's too tired." The woman looked reproachfully at Ma.
"Ain't you believers, ma'am?"
"We always been holiness," Ma said. "But Grandma's tired, and we been a-going all night. We won't trouble you."
"It ain't no trouble. And if it was, we'd want to do it for a soul a-soaring to the Lamb."
Ma arose to her knees. "We thank you," she said coldly. "We ain't gonna have no meeting in this here tent." The woman looked at her for a long time.
"Well, we ain't a-gonna let a sister go away thout a little praising. We'll get the meeting going in our own tent, ma'am, and we'll forgive you for your hard heart."
Ma settled back again and turned her face to Grandma, and her face was still set and hard. "She's tired," Ma said. "She's only tired." Grandma swung her head back and forth and muttered under her breath. The woman walked stiffly out of the tent. Ma continued to look down at the old face. Rose of Sharon fanned her cardboard and moved the hot air in a stream. She said,
"Ma."
"Yeah?"
"Why'd you let him hold a meeting?"
"I dunno," said Ma. "Jehovahites is good people. They're howlers and jumpers. I dunno. Something just come over me. I didn't think I could stand it. I'd just fly all apart. From some little distance, there came the sound of the beginning meeting, a sing-song chant of exhortation. The words were not clear, only the tone. The voice rose and fell and went higher at each rise. Now a response filled in the pause, and the exhortation went up with a tone of triumph, and a growl of power came into the voice. It swelled and paused, and a growl came into the response. And now gradually the sentences of exhortation shortened, grew sharper, like commands. And into the responses came a complaining note. The rhythm quickened. Male and female voices had been one tone, but now in the middle of a response, one woman's voice went up and up in a wailing cry, wild and fierce, like the cry of a beast. And a deeper woman's voice rose up beside it, a baying voice, and a man's voice traveled up the scale in a howl of a wolf. The exhortation stopped, and only the feral howling came from the tent, and with it a thudding sound on the earth. Ma shivered. Rose of Sharon's breath was panting and short, and the chorus of howls went on so long it seemed that lungs must burst. Ma said, "Makes me nervous. Something happened to me." Now the high voice broke into hysteria, the gabbling screams of a hyena. The thudding became louder. Voices cracked and broke, and then the whole chorus fell to a sobbing, grunting undertone, and the slap of flesh and the thuddings on the earth. And the sobbing changed to a little whining, like that of a litter of puppies at a food dish. Rose of Sharon cried softly with nervousness. Grandma kicked the curtain off her legs, which lay like gray, knotted sticks, and Grandma whined with the whining in the distance. Ma pulled the curtain back in place, and then Grandma sighed deeply, and her breathing grew steady and easy, and her closed eyelids ceased their flicking. She slept deeply and snored through her half-open mouth. The whining from the distance was softer and softer until it could not be heard at all anymore. Rose of Sharon looked at Ma, and her eyes were blank with tears. "It done good," said Rose of Sharon. "It done Grandma good. She's asleepin'." Ma's head was down, and she was ashamed. "Maybe I done them good people wrong. Grandma is asleep." "Why ain't you asked our preacher if you done a sin?" the girl asked. "I will. But he's a queer man. Maybe it's him made me tell them people they couldn't come here. That preacher, he's getting round to thinking that what people does is right to do." Ma looked at her hands, and then she said, "Rose of Sharon, we got to sleep. If we're gonna go tonight, we got to sleep." She stretched out on the ground beside the mattress. Rose of Sharon asked, "How about Fan and Grandma?" "She's asleep now. You lay down and rest." "I wonder where Aunt Connie is," the girl complained. "I ain't seen him around for a long time." Ma said, "Shh, get some rest." "Ma, Connie gonna study nights and get to be something." "Yeah, you told me about that. Get some rest." The girl lay down on the edge of Grandma's mattress. "Connie's got a new plan. He's thinking all the time. When he gets all up on electricity, he can have his own store, and then guess what we gonna have?"
"What?"
"Ice. All the ice you want. Gonna have a ice box. Keep it full. Stuff don't spoil if you got ice."
"Connie's thinking all the time," Ma chuckled. "Better get some rest now."
Rose of Sharon closed her eyes. Ma turned over on her back and crossed her hands under her head. She listened to Grandma's breathing and to the girl's breathing. She moved a hand to start a fly from her forehead. The camp was quiet in the blinding heat, but the noises of hot grass, of crickets, the hum of flies, were a tone that was close to silence. Ma sighed deeply, and then yawned and closed her eyes. In her half-sleep, she heard footsteps approaching, but it was a man's voice that started her awake.
"Who's in here?"
Ma sat up quickly. A brown-faced man bent over and looked in. He wore boots and khaki pants and a khaki shirt with epaulets. On a Sam Brown belt, a pistol holster hung, and a big silver star was pinned to his shirt at the left breast. A loose-crowned military cap was on the back of his head. He beat on the tarpaulin with his hand, and the tight canvas vibrated like a drum.
"Who's in here?"
he demanded again. Ma asked,
"What is it you want, mister?"
"What do you think I want? I want to know who's in here."
"Why, there's just us three in here. Me and Grandma and my girl."
"Where's your men?"
"Why, they went down to clean up. We was driving all night."
"Where'd you come from?"
"Right near Sallisaw, Oklahoma."
"Well, you can't stay here."
"We aim to get out tonight and cross the desert, mister."
"Well, you better. If you're here tomorrow this time, I'll run you in. We don't want none of you settling down here."
Ma's face blackened with anger. She got slowly to her feet. She stooped to the utensil box and picked out the iron skillet.
"Mister," she said, "you got a tin button and a gun. Where I come from, you keep your voice down."
She advanced on him with the skillet. He loosened the gun in the holster.
"Go ahead," said Ma. "Scaring women. I'm thankful the men folks ain't here. They'd tear you to pieces. In my country, you watch your tongue."
The man took two steps backward.
"Well, you ain't in your country now. You're in California, and we don't want you goddamn Okies settling down."
Ma's advance stopped. She looked puzzled.
"Okies,"
she said softly.
"Okies?"
"Yeah, Okies. And if you're here when I come tomorrow, I'll run you in."
He turned and walked to the next tent and banged on the canvas with his hand.
"Who's in here?" he said.
Ma went slowly back under the tarpaulin. She put the skillet in the utensil box. She sat down slowly. Rose of Sharon watched her secretly. And when she saw Ma fighting with her face, Rose of Sharon closed her eyes and pretended to be asleep. The sun sank low in the afternoon, but the heat did not seem to decrease. Tom awakened under his willow, and his mouth was parched and his body was wet with sweat, and his head was dissatisfied with his rest. He staggered to his feet and walked toward the water. He peeled off his clothes and waded into the stream. And the moment the water was about him, his thirst was gone. He lay back in the shallows, and his body floated. He held himself in place with his elbows in the sand and looked at his toes, which bobbed above the surface. A pale, skinny little boy crept like an animal through the reeds and slipped off his clothes, and he squirmed into the water like a muskrat and pulled himself along like a muskrat, only his eyes and nose above the surface. Then suddenly he saw Tom's head and saw that Tom was watching him. He stopped his game and sat up. Tom said,
"Hello."
"Hello."
"Looks like you was playing mushrat."
"Well, I was."
He edged gradually away toward the bank. He moved casually, and then he leaped out, gathered his clothes with a sweep of his arms, and was gone among the willows. Tom laughed quietly, and then he heard his name called shrilly.
"Tom! Oh, Tom!"
He sat up in the water and whistled through his teeth, a piercing whistle with a loop on the end. The willows shook, and Ruthie stood looking at him.
"Ma wants you," she said. "Ma wants you right away."
All right. He stood up and